Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast. Seth Payne here for Payne and Pendergast. If you'd like to be a part of the show, hit us up, man. 713-572-4610. You can text in. You can join the chat and Twitch and YouTube. We'll have Acknowledge Me coming up here in about 20 minutes or so. But I think there's a key question, Seth, that is still looming, maybe now more than ever, for the Astros after Lance McCullers' performance over the weekend. No, I'm not going to say, hey, doom and gloom, you know, Lance is foobar again. We've been there, done that, and then he looked very much like he was starting to put things together before his foot sprain earlier this month. But I do have to say, 3 1/3 and 7 hits, 8 earned runs, 4 walks. I said it before he even went back out there. It's more likely than not Lance is going to be back closer to square one, at least in terms of our expectations for him going into this start against the Cubs, than not. And to me, it answered just one more question about the rotation for the Astros going forward behind Framber Valdez and Hunter Brown. And then that's, if the playoffs started tomorrow and you need three guys to pitch in a best of seven series, Seth, I don't know that Lance McCullers, you feel really good about him being your number three guy. I think that's a TBD so far.
Yeah, I mean, you look at him, he's got a 6.61 ERA. And a lot of that is because of two really, really bad performances versus the NL Central. And yet it's still in there, like an implosion to the degree of which you can't rely upon that. But we've seen, I guess out of the other young guys, we've seen really bad innings and outings. But on the sum total of things, I say other younger guys. I'm treating Lance like I am. I'm kind of throwing Lance in the same bucket as Colton Gordon or Ryan Gusto or some of these other less proven guys, and Brandon Walter, certainly. I feel like at this point, if you had to start a playoff series today, those guys at least, I think, know who they are as pitchers. They're still trying to figure it out. But Lance is still in this process of just figuring out, yeah, who am I going to be this time around? What can I lean into? When can I trust my slider and all of that? Luckily, the playoffs don't start this week, but he's got half a season to figure it out. It's just these are meltdowns, you know? Like, and Lance is always – in this game, he got himself out of trouble in the first inning, and we've seen this so many times from Lance. He has bad first innings, then he gets it all back together. He's just never really able to complete it. The biggest thing he had going for him, honestly, was that the sun was so bad there for a couple of innings, and it's like that was giving him an advantage. And it feels like once the shadows righted themselves, then it was just back to guys. Once they could see the ball, they started crushing them.
Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast. That's Seth Payne. Somebody texted in earlier about Lance McCullers and said they wouldn't be opposed to sending Lance to Sugarland for a month. And that got me thinking, you know, similarly to how they've handled and presumably again will handle Yordan Alvarez, like with this hand injury or any injury, like they haven't sent him for rehab assignments. It's they get him his reps, you know, in the cages and things like that. And he's going to come back up to the, you know, big ball club and just pick up right where he left off in terms of playing time. There's no reps against AA, AAA pitching or anything like that. For Lance McCullers, you know, with his foot sprain, it was, okay, let's see if he's good to go. He wakes up healthy after doing some, you know, fielding work. And as Spotted said, yeah, if he does that, he'll be good to go for Saturday. No minor league, never mind. He was still very much like on the tail end of this ramp up process for having not pitched in the last 2+ years. What did he make, like 6 starts? And then he had the foot sprain, maybe 7 starts it was. I can't remember, but it seemed kind of unnecessary to bring Lance up, especially when you had Gusto and Gordon and Walter, and you had to make do, you know, for a start before with A.J. Blueball and a Jason Alexander. It seemed like Astros could have made it a little bit longer, maybe another time or two through the rotation, and make sure Lance figures it out in the minors before he does in the majors.
Yeah, it was a weird situation because it wasn't the typical either elbow soreness or forearm tightness or anything else. And that I'm guessing in their mind, it was more important just to get him back out there and stay as much in timing and rhythm as possible.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't It wasn't anything to having to do with pitching or his motion or anything else like that. I think at some point it's just got to be, it's got to come down to the, like, all right, they want to trust Lance. They want to see exactly how he's going to develop. And you can't just, you can't treat him with kid gloves forever. I don't like, if he has another stretch here of 5 or 6 games where he has a 3 ERA or so, does it affect how you handle things at the trade deadline? He won't get 5 starts before the trade deadline.
Well, and that kind of brings me back to, you know, my main point is with Lance McCullers, you know, not just his performance, but if we're being honest on what we can really expect from this guy this season, don't the Astros need to go out ahead of the deadline and try to find this year's version of Yusei Kikuchi? Because we've talked to Bob Nightingale and Ben Verlander 2 out of the last 3 weeks, and I've asked them, you know, PC's, you know, very much lobbying for putting the feelers out there like, hey, the Astros need a trade for a pitcher, or what do you think, a left-handed bat, which one? And both of those guys, when asked to pick one, they've sided with the pitcher. Because at some point in time, I feel like they're all comfortable, and maybe we should be a little bit more comfortable with it as well. When Yordan Alvarez comes back, you're anticipating this guy. If he's healthy, he's going to freaking hit. He's one of the best hitters in Major League Baseball. But when you're in a 7-game series, you need something more consistent behind Framber Valdez and Hunter Brown. Lance McCullers can't provide you that. I don't know that we should be expecting Luis Garcia, if he comes back later this summer, or Christian Javier, and like cross your fingers for those guys, that they're going to be able to offer you anything that makes you feel great about them getting into a 6th or 7th inning in a playoff game.
I look at the pipeline and just how it still needs to be stocked up so much more so. And I tend to look at one of those guys, either Javier, Arrigetti, Garcia, probably not JP France, but still maybe JP France. And the combination of those guys plus some of the younger guys, the rookies and the less heralded guys that have had to start over the last month, that's your trade deadline acquisition. If Arrigetti, you went into this season expecting Arrigetti to be one of your guys, and it's a broken bone, if they're careful with it and he comes back. I know that the Astros don't have a great history with broken bones. They don't have a great history with Tommy Johns. They don't have a great history with guys coming back. But it feels like between Javier Arrigetti and Garcia, you'd have to think at least one of those guys is going to end up being a reliable starter and the better version of himself by the end of the year.
You know, they don't have a great history of that stuff. You're right. Because they haven't admitted right away that, hey, a guy's going to need Tommy John. No, he's got neck discomfort. And, oh, by the way, a few weeks later, he needs Tommy John. No, it's just a bruised shin. And then a few weeks later, nah, it's actually broke. At least with Spencer Arrigetti, they'd said right off the bat, like, yeah, it's a broken finger. Here's my question, though. Is it really a broken finger or is it a broken hand? Because the dude's been out for a really long time. He's been out for a really long time. And I know it's his pitching hand and a finger. You need a heel to work on gripping things and, you know, moving it around and throwing baseballs really hard. I get that, but it just feels like it's a little bit more than a broken finger at this point in time.
It feels like more than that. Jeremy Pena gets plunked in the ribs and he goes out, and immediately everybody is on a panic level 10 because, all right, no, there's no part of the Astros saying that the ribs aren't broken by this point where people feel like, okay, we can trust your ability to read x-rays. So there's the two concerns on Jeremy Pena's front are, one, the bruised ribs. It's hopefully just simply a bruise. And then two, obviously, that he went out and hired Scott Boras as his agent last week. Dana Brown had said on the pregame radio show, the team's pregame radio show, that he called Scott Boras right away after Jeremy Pena hired Boras as his agent. Brown said he told Boras that we're still interested in signing Jeremy long-term and we'll be in touch. Did that make you any more optimistic about Jeremy Pena actually sticking around here longer than the next couple years?
I mean, more optimistic? Slightly, maybe. Maybe it's more like a meh. And here's why, because Alex Bregman, Kyle Tucker, that just happened. And I was looking back at some old articles from Chandler Rome and other people covering, you know, the Astros when Dana Brown first come in and talking about, like, these guys should be Astros for life. Who is he talking about? Alex Bregman. He's talking about Kyle Tucker. He's talking about Framber Valdez. These guys should be Astros for life. Jose Altuve. Well, that's probably going to happen, right? But anybody else that is of age to where it makes sense for them to get a deal longer than 5 years, in this case, it would make sense for Jeremy Pena to get a deal for longer than 5 years, they're going to have to break contract protocol, their belief, their philosophy, in order for that to happen. And that's actually something that I wanted to talk about a little bit later on, and we will, because there's another name that I think we can throw into that scenario with the Astros. Tease, I think that's coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, but that's a great question.
Well,
I don't have a very confident answer for you because of track record.
When they've been able to pull off an extension, it tends to be a discount for the player. The player is taking less than what the free agency money is. Yordan is one of the best deals in baseball when he's healthy. Obviously, Altuve is. Kind of worked with the team and definitely said, all right, I'm not going to try to get free agency money from the Astros a couple of times now. And now that Boris is his agent, even though Boris worked on those extensions with Altuve and with McCullers, I think that Pena has no reason to fear some kind of cataclysmic injury or something that's going to drive down his value. He's set himself at a pretty high bar for what teams are probably going to pay. And that's where I don't see the Astros breaking the mold and giving like genuine free agency type money on an extension.
I hate to agree with you, but I do right now until proven otherwise. 713-572-4610.
Especially because he's going to be in an age, he'll be 1 year younger than George Springer was when he became a free agent. And you could see George hasn't been the same guy in his 30s, as, you know, he's had some really good moments and some really good stretches, but he hasn't been the same guy in his 30s that he was in his 20s, obviously.
Yeah, no, you're right. And what, Pena's 27, going to be 28.
He'll be 30 when he's a free agent, or when he runs out of arbitration.
Yeah, he's got two more years of arbitration. So you've got arb years you could buy out there. And the initial report, I think you mentioned this, but you mentioned him switching to Scott Boras. Well, switching to Scott Boras after the Chandler Rome / Ari Alexander reports last week of him in the Astros being very deep into conversations and actual numbers being thrown out. You remember, it took us forever to get actual numbers publicized by way of offer from Astros to Alex Bregman. And I don't know that we ever saw or heard numbers as it relates to Kyle Tucker, but we've got numbers in the early return for Jeremy Pena, 5 years and north of $105 million. Bob Nightingale told us last Friday that he heard it was 5 years, $100 million on the nose. So there's $20 million AAV right there, and Pena's like, sounds like I'm going to need a little bit more. Let me go give Scott a call. You know?
Yeah. I mean, it's just Lindor is making $34 million a year. Correa is making $33 million a year. Seager's making $32 million a year. That's what the top shortstops are being paid. Where,
well,
if I'm paying you, yeah, $20 million is, don't get me wrong, it's a lot of money, but that's nowhere near the area that we're looking at.
But see, it's a very dangerous line. And I was adamant, you know, when I first brought this up on Friday night show with Patrick, and I'd said, boy, that sure feels like a lowball offer to me, man. You know, $20 million AAV. And I'd said that because I looked at the highest paid shortstops in Major League Baseball. 11 shortstops are inside the top 100 in terms of average annual value. The lowest one amongst those 11, Wander Franco, and he's going to jail for 2 years. Was $16 million and change AAV. The guy before that, all 10 of those shortstops in the top 100 are making at least $23 million. So that AAV number, didn't touch that. It's close, but no cigar. So Boras is going to be looking for that at the very minimum and probably a lot more.
Yeah, no, that's where, and you know, if you get up to the top five, it's $25, $26 million per year. So maybe they're not as far off, depending on just how long they want to make the contract. It's, but I mean, like Peña at this point right now has got to be looking at, okay, there's potential for a 7-8 year deal out there with just a boat, whatever the AAV is. Just a boatload more guaranteed money, and I'm not optimistic right now that it's going to get done.
Yeah, we'll see though. Maybe we'll be pleasantly surprised. It can't stay the same the whole time, can it? Like forever? Like they're going to have to break mold at some point in time.
I think part of it is they trust their ability to develop prospects too. They've always been better than what Baseball America says the pipeline is. They've always just managed to, whether it's with their quote unquote old Latin American pitching prospects, because guys are the guys that didn't get signed until they were 19 or 20 years old, end up way overperforming whatever their grades are, or you know, like Peña's a third round pick. And was just laying in wait for Carlos Correa to leave, and they felt really, really good about him. So I think they trust their ability to develop players enough that they don't feel the same frustration that we do as fans. I think they just the Astros have gotten really, really good at emotionally detaching.
I agree, and that's not a bad place to be. You know, but at some point in time. Because you have done it before with Yordan Alvarez, and you know we'll see what happens in more of the Dana Brown era. But there is something to be said for, hey, you develop a guy, they're really good, and even though maybe they didn't blossom until their fourth year in, there's nothing wrong with signing him. Dana Brown said in the very early stages of his taking the general manager job with the Astros that, you know, there is a place for longer term contracts. You know, maybe he didn't believe necessarily in the tenure type deals. And so him and Jim Crane see that eye to eye. But there's a window between 5 and 10 years that maybe does make sense for particular players. I feel like now in Major League Baseball, because of a guy like Christian Walker, I get there's some inherent risk there for a late bloomer. You know, who didn't get good at baseball until like the age of 30, and now he's 34 and like, hey, where is this guy? He fell off a cliff. Maybe you're guarding against that with Jeremy Peña, but to me it says a whole hell of a lot that you even got to discussions with Jeremy Peña at the age that he's at with two arb years left and a pretty solid offer, you know, all things considered in terms of you weighing the risk reward for a 28-year-old guy going forward.
Well, that's where, I mean, and Yordan got in his extension $19 million a year. And that's where if they'd gotten Peña before he started having this season, Peña might have seen some of the, okay, I'll take financial security, man, that's a lot of money. And like, but now he's got the second or third highest war in baseball at any given time. He's third in the AL MVP odds. You know, it's a distant third right this moment, but just he's been a completely different guy than the guy that they maybe could have gotten at a discount at $19 million a year.
Yeah, he's been awesome. He's been awesome. More on the Astros here in just a second. Acknowledge me. We've got a handful of individuals from over the weekend that we have to acknowledge, and we've mentioned some so far. Seth, I put together this list. If you want to throw in somebody else that you feel like deserves our acknowledgments, feel free, sir. You can go right ahead.
I reviewed your list, and it's a really good list. So I don't think I have anything to add unless we get to the end and we've already we've got time to kill.
And no particular
one entertainer I need to acknowledge.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll do that. I was going to say in no particular order. Cam Smith was the first guy that I thought of when I was putting this list together. Two home runs, and you mentioned the clutch factor from Cam Smith. Two home runs in this Cubs series. What he's been doing over the course of the last 10 games, 15 games, you go back to about 40 games now, Seth. This guy is not playing checkers anymore. He's playing chess. No stage, no moment within a game, high leverage. It doesn't mean anything. This guy loves to help this ball club succeed in big moments. He plays with that fire, that passion that Jeremy Peña plays with. And we've seen it from Cam day one.
No, and he ended up in 400 over the course of these last two series versus the Phillies and the Cubs. So two of the best teams in the league, and he shows up and delivers. He had until yesterday, he had a hit in every single one of those first five games of the six-game series, or the combined series. And I think to go out and watch him hit home runs in consecutive nights versus the team that traded him away, that's exactly the kind of – that's the kind of pettiness that I encourage in athletes. That's there's probably no actual ill will or anything, but you still want to stick it to the team that just said, "Ah, we got no use for you." We need to bring in Kyle Tucker and really bring in a real ball player to try to make a push to win the World Series. No, good job, Cam. Doing it versus the Phillies was nice, but doing it versus the Cubs especially was really, really good.
Anytime you can do that against a more higher profile team, especially the organization that you made dealings with this past offseason for, like, that's huge. People are going to start to take notice. And when somebody says, "Hey, nobody's talking about this guy," usually pretty soon thereafter, everybody's going to be talking about this guy, especially when that person's like a Ben Verlander, right? And Ben Verlander on his Flippin' Bats pod last week had said, "Dude, people are sleeping on this guy, Cam Smith. Like, look at what he's doing and how he's doing it." And now he could say who he's doing it against. Anytime you can do that against your former team that kind of said, "Yeah, you know what? We're good. We're going to go ahead and roll the dice on a guy that we probably can't afford to trade for and sign to a long-term extension, because Kyle Tucker now could maybe command somewhere between $500 and $600 million at season's end." That's a pretty cool feeling for Cam Smith to be able to do that.
He's tied for 7th in AL Rookie of the Year odds right now. He's at 50-1.
Yeah.
Which I would, amongst position player, position non-pitchers, he's got the highest war of rookies in the AL. So that's an interesting one right there. If I were a gambling man, I might just monitor that a little bit.
Yeah, sprinkle. Put a little sprinkle on there. Drop a hundo or a couple hundo on that and see what happens. Let it ride. Next guy, Brian Abreu. Got to acknowledge Brian Abreu, one of the most dominant two-inning relief appearances I think you'll see from Brian Abreu was yesterday. Struck out Cubs hitters, the 9-1-3-4 guys, in a span of two innings, included two pop-outs to Michael Bush and Kyle Tucker. He was absolutely filthy. Brian Abreu, watching that in person, I don't know that I've ever seen him look as electric as I did yesterday.
Yeah. Was that, where were you sitting in the ballpark?
Oh man, I love these seats. It was section 324 between home and first base. It was a great vantage point. It was kind of like terrace deck. So one level just above the suite section, and we had first row seats. It was fantastic.
So you can sit there and watch the drop on his slider and everything and get a feel for what it's like to try to hit Brian Abreu when he's looking like that.
Yeah, a little bit. You know, the only thing, the best seats in that house for me, like, you know, it's subjective, personal preference. Same vantage point, but maybe like, what is it called? Club level. If you're on the club level, to me, those are perfect.
So he's stranded 11 of the last 12 runners he's inherited, and has just looked unhittable at points over these last few games. And then I guess we acknowledge Hader already, right?
I was saving Hader, but he's definitely on the list.
Okay, we'll save Hader. Okay. I think the bullpen in general. And just despite hiccups here and there, it's like this is what you have to ride into the Astros. If they win a World Series this year, it's going to be with some of the most agonizingly small margins in a series against good teams. I don't like if the Astros are going to win a World Series this year, it's not going to be because they score 22 runs against the Dodgers or like any of those performances of the past.
Feels that way.
You're going to have some super, super clutch, intense moments that last like the final four innings of just maintaining a one-run lead. And that's what I'm bracing myself for.
Well, and we're going to get to the point to where we're going to ask that question at nauseam. How sustainable is this? You know, the way that this club hits.
Oh, I'm done asking it. It's sustainable. I've seen it long enough now that I feel like it's sustainable. Look, give me five good innings out of some starting pitcher I've barely heard of, and then release the hounds from the bullpen onto them and just hope for one or two clutch runs here or there. All you need is yeah. Paredes to come through with a guy on base, or Cam Smith to hit a home run, or whatever it might be. That's what this team is.
All right, let's get to Josh Hader. Josh Hader. Acknowledge that guy, man. Stand up and acknowledge Josh Hader. Franchise leader now for the most consecutive saves to start a season. The number's at 23. Broke Dave Smith's record of 21 straight on Friday night. He, too, was really freaking good yesterday once again, Seth.
Yeah. Josh Hader is obviously... there's not really any irony or anything, because this is a stretch that he's just continued. But having Ryan Presley back in the house, and Ryan Presley and Kyle Tucker, many acknowledgments, just because I thought the fans did a great job of showing those guys some appreciation. Those guys, showed it back. Great. That's all well and good.
Yeah.
But the awkwardness or uncomfortable nature of last year, where Presley's getting demoted for Hader, and then Hader's not pitching as well as he should have or could have. Like, all of that's just been, it's so far in the rearview mirror now that I'm just glad to be done with it.
You know, I have not taught my boy, like, at least on purpose. You know, he's learned, I guess, kind of from observances, but he gets it, man. You know, he's 5 years old. He was applauding, and he loves Kyle Tucker, has the bobblehead and a shirt and all this stuff. And so Kyle Tucker, batting second, first at bat yesterday. Yeah, Tucker, go Tucker, yeah. Later on, when he came up, I think again in the third inning or whatever it was, third or fourth inning, my boy, boo! And I'm like, no. Don't boo Tucker. He's like, hey, I'm going to give you your love the first at bat, but after that, gloves are off, dude. You're a Cub.
I like him, yeah. That's the right kind of killer mindset that we need, Sean. He's going to overcome your softness.
I was yes. like, I said, don't boo Tuck, man. Don't boo Tuck. I mean, it's okay. You know, just give him the ball. Same thing with Presley, you know. It's like, yeah, Presley, let's go. And then five pitches in, he's like, boo! Like, stop, bro, stop. You're good. Let's acknowledge Rafael Stone. Rockets general manager Rafael Stone. Here's the offseason this dude has put together so far. And let's go Rafael Stone / Ime Udoka if we're being real about it, Seth. But they've re-signed Steven Adams on a 3-year, $39 million contract. Udoka got a long-term extension that makes him one of the highest-paid coaches in the NBA going forward. They traded Green, Brooks, the 10th pick, 5 second-round picks for Kevin Durant. Nobody thought that was going to happen for that. You thought it was going to take a little bit more. They signed Fred VanVleet to a 2-year, $50 million deal. I think that raised some eyebrows because of a guy that had an option of nearly $45 million coming into this next season. You get him for 2 years, $50 million, a 1+1 essentially. And then they extend Jabari Smith Jr., 5 years, $122 million contract. And, oh, by the way, Jayshon Tate, Aaron Holiday, Jeff Green, also going to be retained this offseason. Tari Eason, eligible for an extension as well. And who's that 3-and-D guy or guys the Rockets could still get? We're still going to be watching that. But Rafael Stone / Ime Udoka, this front office has done a tremendous job so far for Houston.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest thing about the way the offseason's been handled that I've liked is that you can see with their actions, guys like Fred VanVleet voting on the Rockets, voting for the Rockets. You know, Fred VanVleet just willingly has his option pushed back where he could have just tested free agency as early as possible, but he agreed to work with the team to give them some of that time and latitude to get all of their ducks in a row. And on the margins, they're not as big a deal, but still the re-signing of Steven Adams, obviously. He might have had choices, but he wants to come back here. I think probably VanVleet and Adams probably both knew about potentially Durant being a thing. And Even going to Jock Landale, putting his option, delaying his option. Whichever 3-and-D type guys they end up going after, I do think that they've now kind of vaulted themselves into that spot where older veteran players that have a decision to make might, it's reasonable to expect some guys might be willing to take a little bit of a discount.
Yeah.
Or to just be the guy that can help round out the rough edges. Mm-hmm. That the pull of Kevin Durant, and whether he's involved with it personally or not, that's a testament to, okay, players trust this organization. And that's a bad, like, it's tough when you're an organization that players don't feel like they can really trust. There's a lot of other teams where Fred VanVleet might not have so willingly pushed his option back, because some teams will say, oh, don't worry, we'll take care of you. And then they never take care of you. I think the Rockets have established that players can have an open dialogue with them.
100%. Great points there. I told PC the other day that Rafael Stone in particular has gone from hated to appreciated. Personally, for me, and I think, you know, for you know, speaking a large majority of the Rocket fan base from those days of the exodus of James Harden and Rafael Stone, kind of maybe undermined the reports, at least, of him undermining Steven Silas in when he was coach and the development of the team. Then people thought it should be happening a lot faster than it was. What it is now, it's seems like it's very much worth it.
That part, and I would go back to, you know, pre-Rafael Stone, but when Chris Paul came into the organization, and you kind of, we got the sense that there was a wink-wink that he was going to get a new deal, and that basically the team would have had good reasons to maybe not follow through with that when it came time to do it. Mm-hmm. But that's how you end up getting a bad reputation as a team, is if you try to pull off maneuvers like that and then you don't follow through, that you players won't trust you and they won't work with you on that type of stuff again. You know, the opposite of that would be the Bengals in the NFL. Nobody trusts. That's why I get frustrated with Trey Hendrickson, like when he believed the Bengals when they said they were going to take care of him. Like, that's on you, man. You can't trust that organization.
Yeah.
So you get a lot of extra power and maneuverability when you can talk to your veteran players and work things out with them, and they feel like, okay, this guy's not going to screw me.
All right, talking about football and trustworthiness, right? We've got time for this one. You found Jacob Johnson.
Oh, yeah.
Jacob Johnson, stand up and acknowledge this guy.
It's Jacob Johnson.
Jacob.
It's Jacob. He's one of the guys competing for the starting fullback job with the Texans. But it's him and British Brooks right now. It's intriguing. Mm-hmm. But Jacob, this was him telling a story about when he was with the Patriots and he got injured, how Tom Brady basically, with the power of his charisma, made sure that he stayed in the game.
So when you first came to the NFL back in 2019, you came to the New England Patriots. With that being said, what's your best Tom Brady story?
Oh, man, probably in 2019, week 6, we're at the goal line, first play, run the fullback lead, and I hit the linebacker low. He hits my back somehow, and my shoulder's hurting, right? I can't move my arm, thinking I might go to the sideline, and then Brady looks at me, he's like, yeah, you okay, baby? You know what I mean? I'm like, Tom Brady asking me, so I'm like, yeah, I'm okay, I get back up, I'm like toughing it out. Next play, we run like a quarterback sneak, now my shoulder is really like just dangling there, like my arm is just hanging down, and then, long story short, after everything, after the game, I get a x-ray, and like I broke my shoulder blade.
Oh my gosh.
I was like, I can always say I toughed out a broken shoulder blade because Tom Brady smiled at me.
There we go, yeah.
Listen, if Tom Brady asked you to get on up and get the score, then that's what you do.
That's awesome.
I like that story from Jacob.
Hey, but you saw the video that accompanied his comments. They showed the play that he was describing there, the quarterback sneak afterwards, where he lowers his shoulder into contact, like broken shoulder. He knows he's jacked up, and he still went down with the shoulder and threw a block.
And I'm sure that story obviously, was probably relayed around the Texans office at some point there when they brought him in. I think that the toughness part of it and guys' willingness to play through injury, it's probably one of the kind of under-discussed elements of really, really good teams is that there are some teams that are still pretty old school in the culture, that guys are going to play through injuries. They're not just making business decisions every single week. But it's hard to figure out exactly how you create a culture like that, other than just you got to get a lot of guys on your team that are willing to be like that. I was watching Aaron Glenn's one of his press conferences this weekend from minicamps, and it was interesting how often he talked about just toughness, like how they're looking for tough guys. And he brought up Ronnie Lott, because he had played with Ronnie Lott for a season or two when he was a young player.
Yeah.
And just how that's always been the embodiment of the type of leadership he wants out of his guys that are willing to sacrifice that way. And I think the Texans are closer to being that type of team, where guys just have a reputation for playing through anything and everything. But it takes a lot. It's a lot of things that don't show up on the scouting report necessarily.
Seth Payne, Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast. Let's keep it with Texans. Unfinished business for them. We will explain next at Sports Radio 610. In for Sean Pendergast, I'm Sean Bajani. Seth Payne here, taking you up till 10 o'clock. Hit us up, 713-572-4610. If you'd like to text in, you can hit us up on Twitch and YouTube. Join the chats, watch the show there as well. Seth, a little piece of unfinished business you wanted to get to here in regards to the Texans, right?
This is an interesting one, just because people keep asking me, or they were for a couple of weeks, hey, when's Ariante Ursary, the second round pick of the Texans, the offensive tackle, going to sign? And I didn't really think too much of it because it's not really a story anymore that somebody's not signed their deal until right up towards training camp, because there's everything falls into place. The second round is interesting because only two picks in the second round, as of Saturday morning at least. I haven't double-checked this morning. Only two second-round picks have signed. One of them is Jaden Higgins, and the other is Schwesinger, the guy that was drafted just ahead of Jaden Higgins. And really, you could point the finger right at the Houston Texans for this scenario, because Caserio fully guaranteed Jaden Higgins' contract for the first time in NFL history. The Browns, who had the first pick in the second round, said, all right, well, we'll give Schwesinger a fully guaranteed contract as well. And now everybody else in the second round is kind of waiting to see what happens and whether some of these higher picks in the second round get a fully guaranteed contract or what have you. So the Texans haven't signed Ariante Ursary. And if they don't before training camp, you can blame the Texans, I guess, for that. I don't think that this is a surprise to Nick Caserio. I'm guessing that when he gave Higgins that contract, people, like other teams, might be PO'd a little bit, and because now they're in a position where their draft picks are going to be asking for it. But that's where we sit with the Ariante Ursary contract.
I see now that you put in exactly where that setup was going to take me in regards to a question. The Pablo Torre stuff, he had the story about NFL collusion last week, and it's been building. And I'm here to ask questions, okay? And I'm glad you brought this up, because I have many questions, because I wanted to talk about this last week whenever I first saw this come down from the reporting of Pablo Torre. And I don't understand it enough. It's very convoluted to me. But since you mentioned the Texans and guaranteeing some of these contracts, here's where my mind went, Seth. Are the Texans, by guaranteeing some of these contracts, and maybe other NFL teams are doing similar things with their draft choices this season, but Is this going to turn into something like more than just a trend, but can this facilitate an actual movement that, to bring it back to my point of Pablo Torre and his reporting and talking about like how the NFL, colluded with the owners, in that nothing like the Deshaun Watson fully guaranteed contract that he got back in March of 2022 can ever happen again. Like, we can never do that again. Is this going to facilitate getting kind of like all finding a happy medium?
Okay. So first, to lay it all out, and it's understandable that people are confused about the collusion stuff, because this is what happened. Pablo Torre and Mike Florio said, hey, everybody, we've got it. We've got evidence and proof that the NFL was colluding to reduce guaranteed contracts. And everybody says, oh, really? What's the evidence? we've got this arbitration ruling that found that the NFL was not colluding to reduce contracts. And like Florio and Pablo Torre are besides themselves with frustration that more people aren't paying attention to this. You've offered up a document that says they were not colluding, or at least there wasn't enough evidence to say for sure that they were colluding. So I'm probably one of the few people in America who's actually gone back and read through this entire document. And I kind of side with the I don't want to side with the NFL owners, but I can see why the arbitrator ruled the way he did. There was evidence that the NFL warned owners that spending guaranteed money can get you into trouble, and but you're free to do what you guys want to do. After which, about half the teams in the NFL that year, this was in 2022, increased the amount of guaranteed money they had spent. So there wasn't really specific evidence. There was evidence they had talked about the dangers of guaranteed contracts, mm-hmm. but there wasn't like, I read through the whole document three times. There wasn't like a smoking gun that showed there was a league-wide conspiracy to not give out these contracts. And it was a weak case by the NFLPA. I'm kind of shocked that they thought something was going to come from it.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm not like, that's why I'm not up in arms over it. The fact of the matter is the NFL basically said it was like giving a group of business owners a warning about credit card spending. You know,
yeah,
and saying like, hey, this is what can happen if you spend a lot with your credit card, because that's what you're doing with a lot of the guaranteed salaries and some of the other contract machinations that people are using, is you're pushing money off into the future and it might hurt you. But then you give that warning about credit card spending and teams are free to do what they want. So I've read through, because Florio kept telling us all that we need to be paid attention to this. I'm like, all right, they took it to an arbitrator. The arbitrator said, no, this isn't collusion. And yet somehow I keep seeing all these things saying the NFL was shown to collude on these contracts. The very document you're citing says, no, they were not, right. They were not colluding right. to prevent more Deshaun Watson type contracts.
Okay. But you know, question still stands, aside from, the collusion allegations, that Torre and Florio are, screaming at the top of the mountain. Are we not, like they always say, follow the money? Are we not seeing an increase in guaranteed dollars spent? And do you ever foresee like a time in the next 3 to 5, maybe 7 years of NFL owners doing more of this early on? Like we're seeing with the Texans and guaranteeing, rookie contracts. Could we see this more early on with rookie deals and maybe a percentage increase when they do hit free agency for the first time in guaranteed dollars?
Yeah, no, yeah. I think the way the Texans have done it is exactly the way you should do it. Is that the Texans, I mean, they basically have given Danielle Hunter a 100% guaranteed contract.
Yeah.
Pretty close to it. But you just do it on a shorter term. And that's the that's the part where in football, it's always going to be a little bit different because of the injury aspect. And then the NFL also, because they have to hold money in escrow if you guarantee $100 million, you have to set aside $100 million that sits in an escrow account, not making you money, not earning like the kind of interest that you want to get as a billionaire. So that's one thing that about the CBA that makes it tougher to deliver guaranteed contracts. I mean, ultimately, I'm reading this court document, and one of the big things in it is at the very beginning, it says that the NFLPA, to prove collusion, it's a higher standard that you have to reach than in your normal collusion case. And like that's in the CBA. That's like it's something that the NFLPA could have negotiated the last time.
Yeah.
Like they just the report about J.C. Treader, the union president at the time, called Russ Wilson a wuss for not holding out for a guaranteed contract. It's like you got to do it with players setting a precedent to get those. That's how it was done in baseball. That's how it was done in basketball. Football just tends to have a really weak union.
Yeah, they say Russell Wilson. I heard that, but who's his agent? Who's calling the shots? Like somebody is advising that he not do that for XYZ reasons, and that's well, Russell Wilson. That's a totally different case. You know what I'm saying?
Well, that was when it comes to the quarterback contracts with Russell Wilson, they traded for him as the ownership was transitioning. So the new owner comes in and is new to football, is asking the question that lots of us ask. Like, wait a second, you've got 2 years of control left on this guy. Why does he need a new deal now? And the football people tell the billionaire, like, well, they're kind of divas and blah, blah, blah. At some point, the owner for the pinner, the representing the owners for the Broncos, is just they basically said, no, we're not going to give a guaranteed. We're not going to give a fully guaranteed contract to Russell Wilson. We'll give him what we give him. And it's an interesting. It's really ultimately what it comes down to is that, like, you can talk about, okay, the dangers of guaranteeing the contract as much as you want, but then it's up to other teams to either follow that advice or to be aggressive. You look at the way the Eagles have operated in the last couple of years. By the textbook, they're operating irresponsibly financially. They're not managing their cap properly. And the Eagles would tell you from their Super Bowl parade, we don't care. Go screw yourselves. That's how we feel about you. That's how, the other owners don't want us to spend exactly like this. Go die. That's what the Eagles are saying.
I was waiting for that. I was hoping I'd get a die from Seth Payne at least once this week. There you go. Early going. Seth Payne, Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast. Coming up next, two former Rockets weigh in on the Kevin Durant acquisition. We'll have the audio for you next. Stay there.